This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cunnan in Washington. Bo Xilai, once a rising star of the Chinese Communist Party, learned one of the oldest lessons in politics last week. Beware the Ides of March. The provincial party chief and Politburo not only lost his job, he was publicly rebuked by the party leadership. The purge comes at the start of what was supposed to be a smooth transition of power to a new generation in Beijing and exposed rivalries and splits within the leadership. Rob Gifford, who used to be our man in Beijing, just returned from covering these extraordinary events in his new role as China editor for The Economist. We'll get an update on politics and go on to ask him about China's policy on its periphery, North Korea, the South China Sea, and its border with India, and about policy further abroad. If you have questions about China's foreign policy, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, actor Wendell Pierce on why a city known for great food needs a good grocery store. But first, Rob Gifford joins us from BBC Studios in Oxford. And Rob, nice to have you back on the program.
It's good to be back, Neil.
And how big a deal is the Bo scandal?
Well, it is a big deal for several reasons. I think especially because since 1989, since the suppression of the pro-democracy movement in June 1989, what we've had in Beijing as the economy has expanded to become the second largest in the world, as the China story has expanded to become one of the biggest stories in the world, is you've had political unity apparently at the center, or at least when you didn't and you had some minor differences or even major differences, nobody knew about them. And so this brings to mind to many people what happened in those fateful days, what happened in the middle of 1989 when there was a split in the Standing Committee of the Politburo. And that was, we all saw the bloody denouement that happened in Tiananmen Square as Zhao Ziyang was purged. The circumstances here are very different, but they are very crucial because they say a lot about where China is. It's had these 23 incredible years of growth, 30 years of growth, more than that since Deng Xiaoping started it all in the late 70s. And now we're sort of starting to see these new visions of how China should go forward, these power struggles, the loss of unanimity at the center coming to the fore, and that is bound to affect what happens in China in the coming decade.
And how do we define this split? Bo was known as a retro-Maoist, if you will.
He was. It's very strange story, and it's very complex also because of who Bo Xilai was and is, the son of one of the Long March veterans, one of the old revolutionaries, really. So he got a lot of protection on his way up the ladder to the top. I think crucial here, though, is that actually when he was moved to Chongqing, in many ways it was a lateral move. And I think, in spite of what I've just said, that it shows that there are splits at the top. I wonder if actually a lot of this, what has gone on in Chongqing in the last 5 years, has not necessarily been a split between the people who want more kind of Maoism or back to Maoism, although there are plenty of people who feel that. I think Bo Xilai has been very opportunistic and quite populist in grabbing hold of those people who want that, who are annoyed and angry that they've been left out of the reforms. And he's used that theme, in fact, to bolster himself. So there's a lot of ego, a lot of individualism going on here as he has pushed for a place on the top nine, the standing committee of the Politburo. So I think there's an element of power struggle, there's an element of individualism and ego, and actually Bo Xilai, very interestingly, he's really about the only politician in China who has anything that you could call a Western politician's sort of nous and savvy and press the flesh, get out and shake hands, and he's very urbane. I've met him, I've interviewed him in Beijing when he was Commerce Secretary. He's almost like a Western politician politician and all the other grey guys in the Politburo, who most of us would have trouble even naming. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very different sort of approach to politics. But here's a crucial thing, Neil. Chinese culture, which has not changed so much under Maoism from what it was in Confucianism, that is not the way politics is done in China. As the United States goes through into its campaign and everyone wants to make a name for themselves and vote for me, 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 it's all about me, how can I show you about me? China is the exact opposite in terms of its political culture. And the person who stands up and tries to say, hey, this is all about me, is often slapped down. And that's not just a Maoist communist thing, that's a traditional Confucian thing as well.
There is also another issue, as you mentioned. He is the son of a revolutionary hero, a man who was on the Long March with Mao, and part of a group known as the Princelings, I gather. Yet he was replaced on the 25-man Politburo by another Princeling.
That's right. And what you have now, or at least the person who is replacing him in Chongqing, is also the son of one of that generation. And so many people are now complaining about this, partly, of course, because originally the Communist Party rose up to oppose the sort of dynastic politics and the father-to-son power and the landlords and the established hierarchy of power of the old China, as it was called. Now what you've got is another institutionalization of family politics, if you like. I'm not sure we in the West, looking at the last few presidents of the United States, perhaps over the last 20 years, or indeed in other Western European countries, where of course there are political dynasties as well. We can necessarily point the finger too much on that one, but it's what's clear is that these families are very, very important in China now, and it taps into a whole social feeling about the lack of social mobility. For some time after Mao died, there was a degree of social mobility, and people could move in and people could move up. There is a slight feeling, not just politically now, but socially, that the haves are getting more and the have-nots are getting less, and they're being locked out of this. So it feeds into some of this social anger as well.
We did talk with you last month before your trip to Beijing about the internal Chinese politics, and we wanted to focus with you today more on China's foreign policy, both immediate neighbors and further afield. 800-989-8255 if you've got questions about that. Email talk@npr.org. But Rob Gifford, I do have to ask whether this Bo affair, allegedly, now there's a document being circulated from the Central Committee that says the issue behind all of this was corruption by Bo's family. An official in Chongqing wanted to investigate. He fled in fear for his life when Bo objected to that. But is this a senior Chinese official being held accountable for corruption, or is this people settling scores? Is this people using this issue as they might use any other issue?
It's very much the latter, I think, and I think we should see most of this as largely an attempt to bring down Bo Xilai for the reasons I've said, because he was getting a little bit too big for his princeling boots, and he needed to be brought down a notch, and a lot of people objected to his very populist, very Western-style politicking, even though some of his policies were not particularly Western-style. He was reinforcing the power of the state-owned enterprises in Chongqing and going back to singing Maoist songs, so not politically, not particularly Western politics, but Western politicking in terms of style, so I think basically a lot of people wanted to bring him down and not allow him to get into the standing committee, and that's really largely what this has been about. And as I say, it's raised these other fascinating issues, because the interesting thing about Bo Xilai is that even though he used his power to, you know, carry out some, by most accounts, some pretty shocking purges of anyone who stood up against him, and to take down business rivals and, you know, sort of real mafia style stuff. He was actually, and is actually, very popular among ordinary people. So that's another weird kind of sort of current that is playing into all this. There are lots of people who feel that life is now unfair in China. And Bo Xilai tapped into that, and he said, don't worry, we'll go back to the days when everyone was poor, but they were equal. And, you know, he chose to gloss over, of course, the horror of the Cultural Revolution. But he tapped into an anger that is there on the streets in a lot of cities in China, not just in Chongqing. I've been in lots of cities in China where people, taxi drivers, you know, the proverbial taxi driver, saying, you know what, that Bo Xilai, he at least he cares about the people and he's trying to crack down on corruption. But of course, anyone who's an official in China is corrupt. So the cover of accusations of corruption against Bo Xilai was relatively easy to make, because you can always find something, because as every Chinese person will tell you, there are no clean officials left in China.
And interestingly, just a few seconds before we go to a break, but among the accusations made indirectly at him was that these retro Maoist policies risked a revival of the Cultural Revolution. That's pretty serious stuff.
It is. And when those sort of accusations start getting thrown around, as they were, as you say, by Wen Jiabao, the current prime minister, you know, that raised a lot of eyebrows. And I think part of that was just the sort of tarring of trying to say, hey, don't go there with Bo Xilai. He's dangerous. And this is why we're doing this.
And is he done? Is he his career over?
Well, I think it is within the Communist Party. The question is if it goes any further. Two very senior Politburo members who've been purged in the last 20 years have been put in jail. The question is whether that will happen to him. My own sense, probably not, but you never know.
Rob Gifford, China's foreign policy next. If you have questions about it, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Rob Gifford, now China editor for The Economist. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. We're talking about the growing power of China. That country's economic boom helped sustain the global economy through the recent recession. It's also given Beijing more clout in Asia, in Africa, the Middle East, around the world. We're talking with Rob Gifford, former NPR foreign correspondent, now China editor at The Economist. We spoke several weeks ago about internal politics in China, a little bit more about that in the previous segment. Now let's focus outside their borders. If you have questions about China's foreign policy, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Rob, here's an email from Richard in Birmingham. It's been over 5 years since I was in northeast China, not too far from the border with North Korea. Local government officials I spoke with then pretty much regarded North Korea as an embarrassing drag on their economy, both regionally and nationally, but felt obliged also to support North Korea for many deep and historical reasons, as well as fervently hoping North Korea would soon reform. I'd like to hear Mr. Gifford's take on China's attitude towards North Korea now. And let me throw in, and what's their opinion of the new North Korean leader?
Yes, I think, as I sort of said regularly, in fact, when I was reporting for NPR, you know, when the poor people of Northeast China are looking down on you and thinking how pitiful you are, you're in a bad state. And that was very much the sort of situation, despite, of course, the many people who are getting richer in China. There are a lot of poor people around that border area. And they always used to say when I went to interview them, they're so pitiful in North Korea. And I think that is very much the feeling among people that this is just so pathetic. And as many people now start to prosper and have been prospering for some years now in Chinese cities, they don't understand really why North Korea doesn't do the same things. Frankly, I'm not sure most Chinese people even give it a second thought. They're so busy trying to make a buck that that they don't think about in international issues like that. From a political point of view, though, I think North Korea is a big headache for the Chinese. I think basically they probably don't have as much influence in Pyongyang as people in the West think, and I think all they want to do in Beijing is to stop North Korea collapsing, because they don't want to see a united Korean peninsula, and so they will do what it takes, dealing with the new leader Kim Jong-un, and just drip feeding him enough through the border across the Yalu River to keep him in power, so that North Korea doesn't implode.
Let's go next to Clifford, and Clifford with us from Miami.
Hi, good afternoon.
Go ahead.
I wanted to get your view regarding China's relationship to a lot of the countries in Africa, meaning that there seems to be a lot of investment going on in Africa. Doing a quick comparison to how the United States has been dealing with Africa over the last few decades, which seems to be a lot more,
Clifford, excuse me, your phone line is a bit is poor, but I did manage to hear your question. I'll relay it to Robin. It's the nature of China's investments in Africa, which he says contrast with U.S. investments there.
That's right, and there are plenty of similarities. Of course, Africa is a very rich country in terms of mineral deposits, in terms of oil, in terms of all sorts of things that China wants, and indeed America wants. The approach is very different, though, because China doesn't attach any strings to any of its policies. So whereas the United States and Western European countries have all sorts of ways in which they try to enforce good governance in Africa as a result of engaging with Africa, and in order to get to, for African countries to benefit from certain aid policies, China doesn't do that. And this is all part of China's non-intervention foreign policy, which is a very important issue we should touch on. The Chinese just go in. They need the mineral resources. They need all of this to keep their economy growing. And they are trying to do it without disrupting the countries where they are and where their mines are and where their state-owned enterprises are extracting all sorts of minerals. But it's very difficult when you've got tens of thousands of Chinese workers, where you've got very often very poor work practices, very poor labor rights situations. You know, we've had situations of Chinese mine owners opening fire on their African workers, you know, because of clashes that inevitably emerge. And I think this is very important to say, because it's part of a much bigger thing about China's coming out into the world, and that is this non-intervention policy. It has always had this non-intervention policy that China will not intervene, unlike you Westerners, mm-hmm. unlike you America, who's always going around poking your nose into other people's business. We, the Chinese, say the Communist Party, will not get involved in that. I think we're basically coming to a situation where that is unfeasible. It can't really go on. They may continue to say it, but China is so out there. So many Chinese people, so many Chinese companies are out in Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, all over. We saw it in Libya. 35,000 Chinese had to be evacuated from Libya earlier when the uprising happened there. And so I think this is a key part of China's emergence now. We're going to have to see them adjusting their foreign policy and how they deal with some of their nationals who are abroad, and what they're doing in continents like Africa.
You talked about their non-interventionist policy. Is it fair to look at it another way? Outside of their immediate neighborhood, is it fair to say Chinese foreign policy is all about whatever materials they can extract, be it iron, be it petroleum, be it whatever, that they need for their economy?
That is very much a part of it. And there are obviously several strands to that. One of which is just that they want to develop their economy, which they have every right to do. We all did the same with ours over the centuries. There is a social stability element. They need to keep the economy ticking, so they need all of this stuff to keep the economy ticking over. But there is a broader issue, a broader political cultural issue as well, and that's to do with China's soft power, the influence that China can have without using its military, without using politics, the sort of idea of Chinese engagement. And that is going alongside China coming out into Africa and Latin America. They're building these Confucius Institutes. You've probably heard about them in the United States on campuses, sometimes a bit controversial because they are supported by the Chinese government. They get money, they give money to the university in the US or in Europe where they're based, but they're trying to teach Chinese. They're trying to say, look, China's coming out into the world, but we don't want to cause problems. We want to be friends. It's a big push that is accompanying China's coming out to get the resources and the business that it wants internationally. And, you know, again, there's a lot of skeptics who feel that, you know, what has China got to offer in the way of soft power? And of course, there are many controversial issues domestically with China, and not least about the growth of China's military. But they are indeed making an effort. And to come back to Africa, you know, when we start lecturing them on policies in Africa, they do scratch their heads and say, what, like, you white people, excuse the phrase, have got anything to tell us about neocolonialism in Africa? You know, they're very cynical about how the proverbial white man exploited Africa and did nothing for Africa, as they say.
Let's go next to Bill, and Bill's with us from Wausau in Wisconsin.
Oh, hi, gentlemen. Just a quick comment based on your opening remarks before I ask my question. I traveled in Russia, and I traveled across Russia on a motorcycle, so I was pretty much on the ground. But one thing Americans don't understand is the meaning of the word comrade. And until you've traveled in a communist country or an ex-communist country, I don't necessarily think you understand that. But anyway, that said, at least that's my opinion, I wanted to ask about Chinese foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran, because I don't understand right now how much oil is coming out of Iran and going to China. And I don't necessarily completely understand the sources of oil for China. But my guess is that eventually they're going to have to fight for them, just like we do, and it's going to be a dogfight. So soft foreign policy isn't ultimately going to work. They're going to bump up against the euros in the U.S. So I'll let you comment on that.
Certainly. This is part of China's great dilemma. It is now very, very rapidly, it's become a major importer of oil from Iran and from other places. And how can it secure the oil that it needs in order to keep the economy growing at the level that it needs to grow? It is a huge dilemma for China. It's why it's building these alliances with people. It doesn't mind Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, across Africa, Angola, Mozambique, plenty of places.
Sudan,
it doesn't mind
where it
gets it from. Sudan, exactly. And that affects its policy. That affects what it does and doesn't do on the UN Security Council. And in fact, these issues, I think, oil and indeed water, there's a water emergency in northern China. Absolutely, there's no water in China. These resource issues, many of them are going to be the things that really, really could push China forward and spark, if not conflicts, confrontations that are going to be very dangerous. It may well not be something to do with the military, although who knows, in the South China Sea, there's plenty of scope for misunderstanding. It could well be these resource issues of China needing to secure these resources it needs that lead to some of the dangerous confrontations of the next decade.
Just to follow up to Bill's question, this is from Ron in Alexandria, Virginia. Rob, thanks for all of your great coverage on China over the years on NPR. What is China's motivation for political support of Iran in the UN? Oil, sovereignty, to subtly agitate the USA on the international stage, or all of the above?
Yes, all of the above, I think. Always good to needle the Americans to some extent. Part of it is, of course, this lingering non-intervention policy that it feels strongly about. It's not just a cover. China has suffered greatly from the intervention of our countries over the years. Speaking to you from England, it is a deep historical thing for China that it doesn't want to do what it has seen other countries do. But a lot of it is just very, very pragmatic. And that's something we see about China and that we say about China over and over again, that people talk about communist China as though there's some kind of ideology governing China in a communist sense. Of course, it is still a Leninist state that brooks no opposition whatsoever. You will be crushed if you oppose it. But within that, it is a remarkably unideological state in terms of communist rhetoric, in terms of communist policies, and it's very, very pragmatic in terms of getting what it needs, getting what it wants in order to push the economy forward.
Rob Gifford, now China editor for The Economist. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go next to Julia. Julia with us from Hillsboro in Oregon.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm just wondering, the commentator right here. See, what is his view for China's South Sea conflict with the surrounding countries, and was the policy effective or not?
This is the dispute over the South China Sea, access to which there's believed to be large deposits of oil underneath it, which exacerbates it. But, of course, parts of it are also claimed by, the Philippines, Borneo, Indonesia, Taiwan, and Vietnam as well.
That's right. Yes. And this is, in some ways, it touches on what we've just been talking about, the need for resources. That is one of the reasons why China is so belligerent about its ownership of the South China Sea, or the sovereignty, that it comes under the sovereignty of China. Very interesting, just in the last couple of weeks, and in fact, you can read about it in this week's issue of The Economist, out on Friday, if I may, China in the last couple of weeks, very interestingly, has made some suggestions that have appeared a little bit more conciliatory. And it's a bit like old-style Kremlinology. You go through the verbs that they use, and these seem to be slightly softer verbs than what they used previously. And there's a little bit of that about it. But China is walking a very difficult line between insisting on what it sees as its sovereign rights, and indeed places where it can get hold of cheap hydrocarbons, of getting fuel that it needs for its growth, but also not annoying all of its neighbors so much that they go running to the umbrella of the United States, which is basically what's happened over the last couple of years. And the whole pivot, so-called pivot of President Obama, back bringing the U.S. Military, reinforcing U.S. military presence in Asia, announced in Bali last November, is a result of China pushing it too far in the last 2 years, and pushing its luck and saying things in a little bit too much of a belligerent way. And so it is realizing the very difficult task it has in dealing with the South China Sea. And certainly it is a potential flashpoint. So I think a lot of people are looking at these recent comments and saying, any progress is good. Any more slightly more soft line from Beijing on how it will deal with this is good.
We hear about its belligerent attitude sometimes towards the South China Sea and other parts of its border areas. We hear about the growth of the Chinese military, which it certainly has grown. Nevertheless, is it not also important to remember the People's Army is not the People's Liberation Army has not fired a shot in anger in quite some time?
That's true. That's very true. And that plays in, I think it was the war with Vietnam in 1979, unless I'm very much mistaken. Externally, internationally, of course, the PLA tragically, brutally were involved in the suppression internally of the Tiananmen demonstrations. But in terms of fighting with other countries, that's true. I mean, I think they, in some ways, they worry about it. Oh dear, another shameless plug, Neil. In the next coming weeks, we've got a big issue about the Chinese military coming up and analysing it. And within that report, with an interview with a general in Beijing, saying, "Well, yes, we haven't had much practice lately, but we don't believe that that you should actually invade other countries in order to get that practice." So, and you know, often a sly dig at America, that's what it's all about, getting the point across that they want to rise peacefully, but who knows if they can. It's just such an unknown, and there are so many variables about China's rise at present.
Rob Gifford, as always, thanks very much for your time, and we'll certainly rush out to our newsstand and buy the next issue of The Economist.
Thanks, Neil.
Rob Gifford, China editor for that magazine. Coming up, actor Wendell Pierce, punk on HBO's The Wire, now a grocer, will explain. It's The Talk of the Nation.